This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, changing the rules, more businesses and workers to qualify for the extended JobKeeper wage subsidy. The Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is my guest. And how COVID is taking its toll on aged care workers.
I see the faces of my staff on a daily basis and, they're long and drawn. They are tired, there's increased sick leave. They are stressed about and concerned about COVID. They're worried about it impacting on them, on their family, of them potentially bringing it into the aged care service.
There's a lot of anger in Lebanon about how government failings might have led to the massive explosion that's devastated large parts of Beirut. And many Lebanese are also frustrated that the government's not doing enough to help the recovery effort. So they're stepping up themselves. Middle East correspondent Eric Dworchek reports.
With brooms on their shoulders, crowds chanted as they marched to work. We'll pay with our blood and soul for the sake of Beirut, they shout. The streets of the upscale Jemaisa neighbourhood near Beirut's port were covered in debris, but now they're clean. Hundreds of volunteers are out helping, clearing shattered glass and rubble so people can return to their homes. Lamia Abdullah has been helping give out food.
The government is non-existent. They are not here. They don't feel responsible. So this is on a personal initiative. We count on each other.
When visiting French President Emmanuel Macron toured the streets of Jemaisa, he was mobbed by a crowd chanting, "The people demand the end of the regime." More than 40,000 Lebanese signed a petition to the president asking France to resume control of Lebanon, while this woman asked him not to send relief funds via the government. Make sure you don't give money to our corrupt government, please, she says. We're exhausted. We cannot take it anymore. Mr. Macron tried to reassure the crowd he'd use the disaster to push for the dismantling of Lebanon's corrupt sectarian political system. We'll bring food and material to rebuild homes, he says. But what's also needed here is a profound political change. Tens of thousands of Lebanese have been protesting since last October, calling for a complete overhaul of a political system that divides power between 18 religious and ethnic groups. Rami Khoury, a professor of journalism at the American University of Beirut, says deteriorating living conditions have made most Lebanese desperate for change.
The governing powers don't seem to care that the citizens are suffering. And they're not just suffering, that citizens are being degraded. They're living less than human beings. Their basic needs are not being met. And the government doesn't seem to care or really do anything about it.
He hopes this explosion will force much-needed reforms upon Lebanon's ruling class.
I personally think this will be a historic turning point.
But there's plenty of hardship ahead. Aid agencies say the destruction of Lebanon's main port will exacerbate existing food shortages and poverty. Assistant Professor in Food Security at the American University, Martin Koilitz, says Lebanon needs a major international effort if it's to avoid famine.
Lebanon could become a Venezuela on steroids. Due to the plunging currency, due to the devastated infrastructure, and due to the lack of available food in Lebanon.
This disaster came on top of Lebanon's financial crisis and the pandemic. Most Lebanese were already doing it tough, but now things could get much worse. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Dworchek reporting for AM.
One of the most poignant images to emerge from the Beirut blast has been a photo of several firefighters trying to pry open the door of the warehouse where the ammonium nitrate that caused this explosion was stored. When they responded to that fire, they didn't know about the deadly material. All are missing, presumed dead. 26-year-old volunteer firefighter Shabil Salame also went to the scene, working for 30 hours straight. He's been speaking to Barbara Miller.
Me and my team, for the past 8 years, we've been firefighters for 8 years. We've seen so many things. We've seen so many victims, but the scale of what you see is out of the world. Like, we have a saying in Lebanon that says, "Al-haki mish mitl al-shawfi." That means no matter how much you say, you speak, it's nothing compared to what you see. We have to see it to understand.
Did you feel safe working there?
Personally, I did not feel safe at all. First of all, the air was filled with ammonium nitrate dust. And in the harbor, we needed more PPE, but we didn't have personal protective equipment enough. We didn't have enough. So we just had dust masks, or some lucky fellows had a few filter masks.
And at what point did you hear that a team of first responders had been killed?
Those teams of first responders, they belonged to the Beirut Fire Brigade. They were dispatched to a fire, and they thought it was a normal fire, and it looked like a normal fire, like a normal warehouse fire that we happen to see once every 2 weeks in the country. And we all work in the same fires, but in a span of 3 minutes, everything went crazy, and we... 8 of them are still missing. We found a few pieces of their fire suits, their breathing apparatuses, but the guys themselves, they're still missing.
Does it make you angry to think about them, or are you just dealing with the sadness of knowing that those lives have very probably been lost?
Honestly, there's like a hurricane of emotions. The constant thought is that, okay, it could be me. It could have been part of my team. It could have been my friends. And what saddens me the most is that they were dispatched to a fire that seemed to be something very normal. But they weren't given any information telling them that there's 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate. 2,750 tons.
They had no chance.
They had no idea it was there. If we had any idea, we would have evacuated the city. It feels like a very bad dream, like something out of a movie. And it's real life.
Beirut firefighter Shabil Salameh speaking to Barbara Miller. You're listening to AM and it's 7 minutes past eight. It's going to be easier for businesses and workers to access the JobKeeper wage subsidy program after September, with the federal government agreeing to a major expansion to try to tackle the economic devastation being caused by the Victorian lockdown. But one thing isn't going to change, and that is the payment is still going to drop from the first week of October. The Treasurer is Josh Frydenberg. Treasurer, good morning. Let's step through these changes. How are you making it easier for businesses to qualify for the JobKeeper extension?
Well, Kim, the Morrison government's committing an extra $15.6 billion to JobKeeper, of which $13 billion will go to Victorian businesses and Victorian employees. We're making two changes. One is to the business turnover test, and the other is to the eligibility employee test. So to be eligible for the December quarter using JobKeeper, you now as a business will just have to see your turnover down in the September quarter, not the June quarter as well. And with regards to eligible employees, they are ones who are on the books as of the 1st of July, whereas previously was the 1st of March. These changes allow for those employees who have come on to into businesses as if they were starting to recover, particularly in Victoria, to now be eligible in light of what's happened with the Stage 4 restrictions. And with businesses who were doing okay through June, April and May, but obviously have been hit very hard by these Stage 4 restrictions in July and August and ultimately into September, so they'll also now be eligible.
So how many extra businesses and how many extra workers do you think are going to qualify now that you've eased the rules?
We believe that about 530,000 extra Victorian employees will now join the JobKeeper program over the September quarter. That means 1.5 million Victorian employees will be using JobKeeper. That's nearly half of the private sector workforce across the whole state.
So you've decided to dump the tightening of the rules that you had planned just a couple of weeks ago, but one thing that you're not changing is the JobKeeper payment itself. It's still going to drop down to $1,200 for full-time, $750 for part-timers from October. Is that because would it have been more expensive to keep the rate at a flat $1,500 rather than making the changes you have?
Well, even prior to these changes, JobKeeper was the single largest economic support package that any Australian government had ever undertaken at $86 billion. We're now topping $100 billion in terms of the cost of this program. We had always planned on it being a national program, which it continues to be, a demand-driven program, but one that transitioned down in terms of the amount the payment was in light of the Australian economy recovering.
But would it have cost you more money if you just decided to, if so many people need help, would it have cost more to have kept the rate at a flat 1500 rather than make these other changes?
Well, of course, if you have it at a higher rate over the course of the December and the March quarters, that is a high cost to the program. But the key point here is that we are actually providing that flat $1,500 payment until the end of September. And as you know, Daniel Andrews, with the Stage 4 restrictions in Victoria, are to mid-September. So we'll continue, obviously, to provide the support in record amounts into the Australian economy.
I'm just trying to understand, sorry to interrupt, I'm just trying to understand what's the rationale, if the need is so dire, what's the rationale for not keeping it at a $1,500 rate?
Well, again, it stays at $1,500 to the end of September. That goes beyond the six-week additional Stage 4 restrictions announced by Daniel Andrews. But still at $1,200, which is where it steps down to for the December quarter, Kim, that's at 80% of the minimum wage. So we as a government are providing major support. If the Victorian government wanted to step in and provide further support, then we would welcome that. We as a federal government have now announced more than $300 billion worth of economic support. The states have announced around $42 billion worth of support. So the federal government continues to do the lion's share of the spending to support the Australian businesses and their workers through this crisis.
Now, you say you're making these changes to JobKeeper because you estimate the economic cost of the Victorian lockdown has tripled to about $10 to $12 billion, up to 400,000 extra people either out of work or on 0 hours. So what happens, for example, if New South Wales has a big outbreak? Are you going to have to find even more money?
Well, that's why we have to make these health measures in Victoria work, because as a country, we're all in this together, and if Victoria has success on the health front, then New South Wales and the other states will all benefit. We as a federal government have deployed around 1,500 Defence Force personnel to Victoria. We've got many Commonwealth officials. We've got AusMed teams. We've released products out of the National Medical Stockpile, all designed to provide Daniel Andrews and the Victorian government
with as much support as possible. I'm just trying to check how deep your pockets might be if another state falls into similar circumstances.
Well, again, we'll always provide the support that is necessary. It's a record fiscal amount that we've already provided, and we'll continue to provide more as need be. But it's really important that people understand, in order to see a national economic recovery, we must see progress on the health front. And as a country, we're at two different stages. We've got Victoria and we've got the rest. And outside of Victoria, people are getting back to work, restrictions are being eased. And we saw that in the most recent job numbers, Kim, with 210,000 people finding a job over the month of June, twice what the market expected. And 60% of those jobs went to women and 50% went to young people. That was a positive sign about the resilience of the Australian economy.
Treasurer, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Good to be with you.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. Well, the lockdown in Melbourne and tighter restrictions across Victoria have presented a unique challenge for the federal MPs from that state. Parliament sits in Canberra, where there are no active COVID-19 cases. So the Victorian politicians are going to have to isolate for 2 weeks before Parliament sits in the last week of this month, or they will miss out on casting their vote. Here's political reporter Melissa Clark.
The Acting Chief Medical Officer has advised that Victorian MPs and senators present a significant risk if they come to Canberra, to both ACT residents and to other MPs and senators. If COVID-19 reaches Parliament House, Parliamentarians returning to their electorates across the country could take the virus along with them. So Victorian politicians have been given three choices. Come to Canberra 2 weeks before Parliament and isolate alone, isolate at home along with all family members before coming to Canberra, or miss Parliament. Independent MP Helen Haynes has made her choice.
I've decided to quarantine at home. I live in northeast Victoria on a small farm. I usually drive to Canberra when I attend Parliament. So I will lock the farm gate and bunker down in quarantine at home and then head to Canberra after that.
The MP says it's important her electorate has a voice in the federal parliament.
As an independent, I don't have a party to do that for me. I'm the one to go to Canberra and make sure the voices of the people here in Indi are heard. So that's very much my obligation. But to do such a thing for a parliamentarian who has a young family would be extremely difficult.
That's the scenario facing Labor frontbencher Catherine King, the MP for Ballarat. Her husband is working from home. She has an elderly parent in hospital and a child adjusting to school closures.
Well, I haven't made up my mind as yet, but, you know, like many families, we've only just started homeschooling here in Ballarat. We've only just gone to stage three restrictions recently, so we just started supervising homeschooling on Wednesday, so we're only on day two.
There are discussions underway about allowing Victorian MPs and senators who can't come to Parliament to participate via video link, but they wouldn't be able to vote. Helen Haynes again.
I'm pleased that at least some consideration is being given to video conferencing in some shape or form, but we've got to do better than that.
For cabinet ministers, it seems there's little choice. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, is having to leave his family in Melbourne.
I'm planning to self-isolate in Canberra.
The same for Health Minister Greg Hunt.
I will. No special rules, no exemption for me.
In Ballarat, Catherine King is still weighing her options.
Don't make a decision until you absolutely have to make a decision.
She has just a couple of days to figure out whether to stay or go.
Melissa Clark reporting. The majority of Australians killed by coronavirus have contracted it in aged care, but the aged care industry is defending its infection control training, arguing it's up to the federal government to provide more specific guidance during the pandemic. Annie Guest reports.
There's been no cases of COVID-19 at the Samarinda Aged Care Facility near Melbourne. But manager Mark Zentgraf says that doesn't mean the last few weeks haven't been tough.
I see the faces of my staff on a daily basis and, you know, they're long and drawn. They are tired. There's increased sick leave. They are stressed about and concerned about COVID in its own right. They're worried about it impacting on them, on their family, of them potentially bringing it into the aged care service.
Morale is also affected at the Queensland aged care home Janine Elliott manages, where she wants to celebrate today's Aged Care Employees Day.
They work very long hours and they do it with love. And I think it's very important, especially in these times, to acknowledge the wonderful work they do.
But much of the news surrounding the sector is unremittingly bleak. This week it emerged at a Senate hearing that less than half of aged care workers have completed the federal government's infection control training. Sean Rooney is the chief executive of Leading Age Services Australia, which represents the majority of providers.
It's not to say that they haven't undertaken other training. We know that many services conduct their own in-house infection control systems, processes and training.
However, the industry has compiled a report for health authorities on what it calls lessons learnt during the pandemic. And with National Cabinet set to meet today, Sean Rooney hopes it endorses specific guidance for the industry.
The process of donning and doffing of personal protective equipment and the disposal of a used PPE and having enhanced focus on, tactile practice and training.
So then is that an admission then that the training in donning and doffing PPE has not been good enough in all circumstances?
No, I think what it is we're fighting something we've never fought before, and part of that is, learning.
The industry also wants the government to issue specific advice on when to send COVID-19 positive residents to hospital.
Annie Guest reporting. As Victoria waits for the new lockdown to drive down corona case numbers, there are 575 COVID-19 patients in hospital. So how is the health system coping and what's it like to care for these patients? Associate Professor Jason Trubiano is the head of the COVID unit at Austin Hospital in the northern Melbourne suburb of Heidelberg. Dr. Trubiano, how many COVID-19 patients do you have at the moment?
So at our Austin Hospital, we have 43 positive COVID patients as of this morning. It's a fluctuating number, but that's the current number that we're looking after at our hospital.
Give us a quick idea of what it's like to care for someone on the ward. Like, what's involved in getting them breakfast this morning, perhaps?
Yeah, so most of our work has been done by our amazing nursing group, to be perfectly honest with you. Their shift starts with probably a 5 to 10 minute procedure of getting into their full PPE, hair nets, gloves, goggles, booties, going into a ward. It can be quite actually hot and uncomfortable in that PPE. They would go to care for the patient. The patient could be young with COVID, or they could be 100 years old with COVID, and obviously they have very different care needs. Meals come into the locked ward in pre-packed special-made containers. Everything needs to be disposed in certain disposable boxes and waste disposal systems. Even the simple task of getting breakfast actually take our staff a long time, just with the precision that's required around that PPE environment.
There are almost 7,500 active COVID cases in Victoria at the moment, more than 500 people in hospital. Infection numbers are still rising. Are you worried about being overwhelmed?
I don't think we're worried about being overwhelmed. I think we're in a different situation to what the US and Europe have faced. We're certainly prepared because we had a practice run, which I called the first ripple or little wave in the first instance. But certainly I am concerned that the number of patients coming through are still too high, and it puts an immense amount of pressure on our staff, medical, nursing, personal care assistants, everybody within the hospital system.
The Victorian Department of Health says more than 1,300 healthcare workers have contracted COVID-19. There are currently 810 active cases, including 48 doctors, 346 nurses. Do you think that that infection rate for healthcare workers is acceptable?
I don't think any infection of a healthcare worker is acceptable. I don't think any of us want to achieve that. But there is a reality when you're dealing with a very infectious virus that healthcare workers put themselves on the front line. It's what they sort of design their careers for, to help. And we want to avoid every avoidable case of contraction. But there's a lot of community transmission going on as well. So we're not just vulnerable to it in the healthcare system, we're vulnerable to it in the community, which is a significant issue as well.
How many of your staff have tested positive?
I don't have that exact number available to me, but we do certainly have healthcare workers across the spectrum, as you've designated, that are infected. And as mentioned, it's really hard to determine, did they acquire that from work? Were they in a hotspot zone and community? Did somebody in their household give it to them? We've got such high numbers of transmission occurring all through Victoria. It's making the task of contact tracers and others very difficult at the moment.
Does Austin Health mandate the use of face shields and P2 or N95 masks when dealing with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 patients?
Yeah, so Austin Health throughout the journey has really conformed to the DHHS recommendations of what we should be wearing in terms of personal protective gear or PPE. And certainly in our COVID-19 ward areas, we wear the N95 where appropriate. In all clinical areas, staff members are wearing surgical masks and face shields, and we are certainly aligning ourselves with those policies. I think it's important that we align with them to try and protect our staff as much as we possibly can.
Dr. Trubiano, thank you very much for speaking with AM this morning.
My pleasure.
Associate Professor Jason Trubiano is speaking to me from the COVID unit at Austin Hospital. In the UK, there's now an embarrassing glut of masks that can't be used in hospitals. It's because the government forked out $250 million for 50 million masks that aren't up to scratch, as Nick Dole reports.
On a building site in Cheshire, Boris Johnson appears in a hard hat. He's come to lay bricks for a photo opportunity about rebuilding the economy. He plonks a giant brick into the cement, only to be told he's laid it the wrong way round.
Yeah, Andrew, we haven't got
it. It's the other way around, pal. Oh, sorry.
Minor as his error was, he was dealing with a much bigger blunder. It's been revealed his government bought 50 million face masks that officials now say can't be used in hospitals.
Well, I'm very disappointed that any consignment of PPE should turn out not to be fit for purpose.
Like virtually every country, the UK scrambled to buy personal protective equipment as COVID-19 took hold. The government paid a firm called Ayanda Capital nearly $500 million for PPE. As part of that contract, more than $250 million was spent on FFP2 masks. The model they delivered used ear loops rather than head straps, and now health officials say they're not fitting tightly enough. Alan Murray from the British Safety Industry Federation says when it comes to hospitals, the standards need to be high.
The face fit is either a pass or a fail. And there are more fails on product with ear loops than there are on product with head harnesses. That means that it wouldn't necessarily provide the protection that was required from it.
Ayanda says it did meet the specifications the government set out, but it doesn't traditionally handle PPE. It's an investment company with links to a government trade advisor. That advisor, Andrew Mills, says his position played no role in winning the contract. But Labor leader Keir Starmer isn't satisfied.
There needs now, I think, to be an investigation, inquiry into what went wrong with this particular contract, because it's not just not good enough to people who need that protective equipment that we find ourselves in this position.
It's not yet clear what will happen to the 50 million masks. Boris Johnson says they're part of a much bigger picture.
Overall, don't forget what we have achieved, a colossal race against time to produce billions of items of PPE, sourcing them from abroad, but now increasingly making them here in the UK as well, and stockpiling them now in case we have a second wave in the autumn and the winter.
That second wave is looking more likely every day. There were 950 new cases reported in the UK overnight. This is Nick Dole in London reporting for AM.
The pandemic sparked a race to find ways to protect people and stop the spread of the virus. And a team of Australian researchers has come up with an idea that could help by purifying air and preventing the infection from spreading through confined spaces such as public transport and elevators. It was the winning idea from a NASA hackathon, as Sarah Sedgie reports.
A hackathon can be an intense experience, but for physicist Dr. Mitra Safavi-Naini, it was a welcome challenge.
I quite enjoy it. It's a very high-pressured 48 hours. It starts normally around Friday evenings when the challenges and the themes are released to all participants. And we knew that our team could work very well together. Our team actually came together during the process of COVID. None of us have been yet in the same room. We haven't met face-to-face yet. But we had this virtual platform that we can get to know each other and throw about ideas.
She's part of a small team of scientists and designers at the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation that has just won a virtual global hackathon convened by NASA. The winning idea, a practical way to make confined public spaces safer.
The system can be retrofitted to enclosed spaces, buses, trains, ferries, elevators. It works in two ways. It removes the pathogens or inactivates the pathogens in air by way of filtering it using the NASA technology of activated titanium dioxide. And once the carriage is emptied at terminal points, it uses UVC to disinfect all surfaces.
Thousands of participants from 150 countries took part. The challenge was to find ways to deal with issues that have come about since the pandemic began, such as social isolation and the environmental factors that help spread the virus. Jay Flack is a clinical physiologist specialising in respiratory medicine and was also part of the team.
So what I did was calculations based on the volume of a lift, the amount of air that's in the lift, and say the average six-person lift, how much air in that lift is potentially contaminated. And the calculations worked out that about 48 litres in a lift is exhaled human breath. So that's an awful lot of potentially contaminated air, 48 litres of exhaled human breath that we rebreathe in a one-minute trip in a lift. So you can see how much of a potential contamination risk that is.
The team will now be talking to NASA and other space agencies about how to make the idea a reality. Mitra Safavi-Naini is optimistic the system can work and help keep the public safer.
traveling on our public transport system should not be a health hazard. So that is what actually brought us to this point. But it is all based on existing technology. So all it requires is a little bit of will, or goodwill, I should say, and resources, and I think we can test it.
Physicist Dr. Mitra Safavi Naini from ANSTO, ending Sarah Sedgie's report. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Everyone was looking for Nicola Gobbo, the woman who became known as Lawyer X.
The woman at the centre of Victoria's biggest legal scandal.
Since going into hiding, the only interview she's done is with the ABC. And now we can tell her full story.
People were going to be murdered.
She was working both sides of the fence.
I will make a point of holding those who did this to account.
The Informer, a gripping new season of the hit podcast Trace. Hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.